No problem. So circumcision is the sign of the covenant. It does set Jews apart from other nations. It is a sign. So, but let's see here. So but it is the sign of the covenant. The covenant being that we belong to Hashem. So let's look at this next paragraph. On the other hand, performing the act only then achieves its full purpose when it does become an oath, a symbol. If it is taken to heart as such, and the idea it expresses becomes a reality for us, meaning you could do it, and it might not be the sign, right? It could be that somebody is circumcised just because that's what the family does, and it never becomes a sign, actually, that you belong to God. It's just a sign that your family...
Well, it's like non-Jews who get circumcised as...
Well, like non-Jews who do, but Jews also today get signed, and it's not really an act of covenant, because, you know, they're serving treif food after that, and maybe it's on Shabbos, and everybody drove, or whatever it is. It's like they're doing it not in accordance, or they have a doctor do it in the hospital, so it's not even really they're doing it because they circumcised, but not with a mole or whatever it is. There are people who circumcise, and it doesn't become a sign of the covenant. Right.
Oh, but we have a mole here. I mean,
there is a mole still. Yeah, yeah.
He just happens to be a doctor also.
Right. We have two now. We have Dr. Seener and Dr. Katz.
Katz, right.
Yeah.
In Denver?
Two. In Denver, mm-hmm. There's two. Yeah. The top one just moved. Yeah. 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 So, but doing the act itself still remains the first carrying out of the commandment of God. What the act is to accomplish is that through it the idea is constantly expressed by us as a declaration of God, and such it is to be firmly held, kept, and constantly repeated and revived for ourselves and for others. So two different things. It is a sign, and what is it a sign for? You can't do the what it's a sign for without doing the sign. You can do the sign without thinking about what it's a sign for. So, but it's best if you do both. That's what he's saying. Yeah, so it's interesting. What time is it? I just want to make
22.
Sure. 22. Okay, 22. Okay. All right, so upon whom this obligation lies, circumcised very young, and also the slaves that are born into the household or purchased for money, and it just talks about the differences in them, and I think does it say details. Who does this fall upon? Who does the mitzvah fall upon?
What page?
So I'm on page 87.
The slaves were also today?
Yeah, so slaves that were becoming Jewish, yeah.
That were becoming Jewish.
The slaves that were bought and not always brought, they didn't always become Jewish. I don't really understand how the slavery system worked. Hopefully when we get to that, I'll know more by then. But there was the concept of buying Jews bought slaves and then made them Jewish. So, but not fully Jewish. I mean, they were fully Jewish, and especially when they were released, they were 100% Jewish. But while they were in the household, they had the same, even if they were male, they had the same level of mitzvah requirements as a female, which is fully Jewish, but exempt from time-bound commandments, so that they would be free to answer to other calls. So slaves were. This Jewish slavery is very different than non-Jewish slavery, and the slave has to be treated very, very well.
Yes.
So part of treating them well is bringing them into the covenant. Okay, so now we see the other, where it says, where is it found and where else? So under where else you can write. Other details are explained in chapter 19 of the Talmud Tractate Sabbath and chapter 4 of the Tractate Yevamot. So 19 of the Talmud Tractate Sabbath and chapter 4 of Yevamot. And there it's explained that the man performing the circumcision, so that's all the details are explained in those two places. And the benediction is, blessed art thou, Lord our God, King of the world, who hallowed us with this mitzvah and commanded us about circumcision. And the father of the child or the religious court, when there is no father, says the benediction. Blessed art thou, Lord our God, King of the world, who hallowed us with this mitzvah and commanded us to bring him into the covenant of Abraham our father. And all those who are standing say, as he merited to enter the covenant, so may God grant him to be able to attain Torah learning, the wedding canopy, and good deeds. So, and then this last paragraph, it remains in force every place and every time. Women have no obligation regarding the circumcision of their sons.
Hmm.
So that's interesting.
But
only the father does, or the Beit Din, where there is no father. So we do hear stories of women who sacrifice their lives to circumcise their sons.
What do you mean
Moses'
wife?
Pardon?
Zipporah.
Right.
Zipporah. She took upon herself. Excellent. Good. Mm-hmm. Excellent.
So why would they have to sacrifice her?
So there's a famous story in the Holocaust where a woman conceals her pregnancy, gives birth, mm-hmm. then is outside, asks a guard for a knife, circumcises her son and throws the foreskin down, knows she'll be killed for doing that because she's now revealing that she has a, that she's a kimpatorn, a newly given birth mother, so she's weak and she has this new baby. She knows her life is gone, but she says, and she says to the guard, you know, or to God at the time in front of the guard, "You gave him to me. You gave me this child. I'm now returning him to you perfect." So so she knows that she's going to be killed for that act.
But her baby will be killed too.
Yeah, right. Right, so that's why
but
she's
she
returning.
Wants to give him back.
The
right.
baby so can, came through her. She's sacrificing them. Both of them in order to do the bris. She probably knows she's going to be killed anyway, but there is that story. Mm-hmm. And then there's a Hanukkah story also where one of the edicts that the Greeks gave to the Jews was no circumcision. So it was no Rosh Chodesh, no learning Torah, no circumcision. And they were specifically designed at undermining the pillars of Judaism. So Rosh Chodesh meaning no calendar. You cannot calculate time the way you Jews do. You'll have to calculate time the way we Greeks do. No learning Torah, no reinfusion of energy into you. You have to take our knowledge. And then no bris milah, no dealing with your body the way that you think it should be dealt with. You should need to deal with it in the beauty way that we Greeks deal with it, and circumcision is marring that. So not enough Jews were rebelling against those edicts, and certainly not militarily. And so Hannah, was Hannah, I think, right? Was it Hannah? Hannah had her seven sons. They're the ones who didn't bow down. Somebody else, I think. And then, oh, the sister of a Maccabee. What was her name? One of the Maccabee sisters is the one who actually started the war. And this is why women don't work during the time that the lights are burning, the Hanukkah lights are burning. It's a special holiday just for them because they're the ones actually who started the war. That so a woman took her son. There was a law, no circumcising. And the men were not battling against the law. And so she took her son up to the top of the walls of the old city, the new city at the time, circumcised her son and jumped off, committed suicide. But to make a public statement that we Jews circumcise, and this is important, and she did it to trigger her brothers to start fighting. So those are two.
What are the unsung heroines?
Right, so those are two stories. But she's unsung except for that really, if anybody knows, who knows, that's why we don't work. Well, that's why we're here, but that's why we don't, well, that's why women don't do work during the time that the Hanukkah lights are burning. For her sake, to say, we women are the ones who started this.
I never knew that.
Hanukkah is in the merit of women.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, then.
So we're the ones.
So we have to make latkes early.
Right. Well, how about letting the men make the latkes then?
Well, you're allowed to make the latkes. Not like Shabbos, you're allowed to make the latkes, but you shouldn't just light the candles and then go finish the laundry or whatever it is. So then you're supposed to. You can make latkes, but it's supposed to be holiday time, particularly for women. So it's not a time to do your mending while the lights are burning or to do the laundry. Right.
Right. Chores. She shouldn't do chores.
Should not be doing chores during that time. Men can do chores during the time. You can ask your husband to take out the trash right after he lit, but not you. Right. Because it's our special time, because the whole Hanukkah victory was started by a woman.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, and so then it says, women don't have this, right, and if you don't do that, then it's interesting that the punishment is that you're cut off, Karit.
Well, except I thought that that was interesting, but then the next part was really interesting, that if the father doesn't do it, that doesn't inure to his...
Right, it is only, interesting.
Yeah, mm-hmm. In other words, if in fact the father fails to do it...
He doesn't get karet over the non-circumcision
exactly.
of his son, right.
In other words, well, and I think it's a very important concept that, you know, is sort of lacking in a lot of people, but that you have to take responsibility for your own self at some point.
You can't
continue to blame your father or your parents or whatever for what's happened to you after you reach a point.
Right.
And it's a very societal thing. I mean, every day now, I had a terrible childhood. It's my parents' fault or whatever.
Right.
I mean, this is an amazing...
Excellent. So that's an excellent point to put into this. Right. You're right. You're right. So father does...
The father was supposed to do it. He failed to do it. It becomes your responsibility. If you fail to do it, you're punished.
Right.
You know?
Right.
There's a period of time in there between the 8th day and the 13th birthday in one day when it's sort of...
Right.
I don't know, I guess it's still the father's responsibility, but...
But after that, it's yours.
Yeah, that's, right. That's really
right. Good.
Very, very
excellent.
Good.
Excellent for pointing that out. Good. Excellent. Okay, let's move to Vayishlach, which we might not finish today. So this is the mitzvah of not eating the sinew of the thigh vein, which I think is the sciatic nerve. I'm pretty sure, but that's what that's how we call it anyway. Whether it is technically, I don't know enough anatomy to know that that's the exact vein, but that's what we call it. Not eating the sciatic nerve. So what is this? This is the story of when Jacob wrestles the angel, and then he's injured by the angel touching him in his thigh, and he limps away into history. And it says, so the verse is, after that story, therefore the children of Israel do not eat the sinew of the thigh vein, Genesis 32:33. So that's the first place that we see this, Genesis 32:33. So it's interesting. So here, let's just see why that is. Is it just to remember that fight? I mean, you have to ask, and refer to ask the question, why? Because of one fight, do all Jews for all history not eat that? I mean, really, it's the whole hind quarter of the animal, right? So half the back half of the animal, we don't eat. And in those countries where we do eat it, it's a lot of work to remove that vein, and expensive to remove that vein, labor intensive to remove it, and then you do eat that meat. But we Americans, we Ashkenazic Jews, don't eat it. In this country, yeah, in Israel, you can't. Today, so we don't eat that vein. You can eat the hindquarter, they will remove the vein. Right, so apparently we in this country have lost the tradition of how to properly remove it or whatever it is, even though we have people who could come teach us now, we don't. So in this country we don't eat it and we don't remove it. Well, nobody eats it, but we don't remove it. But technically you could remove it.
So.
There's no prohibition for doing it. Yeah, I'm
well,
not sure.
I think it's the
tradition that we don't.
Of the, right.
For Ashkenazic Jews. I'm pretty sure it's the tradition of Ashkenazic Jews, and I think Sephardic Jews do remove it and eat it in this country.
I knew I should have been Sephardic.
So, here's what the Sefer Chinuch says is at the root, the why of this. At the root of the precept, second paragraph, lies the purpose that Jewry should have a hint that even though they will endure great tribulations in the exiles at the hands of the nations and the descendants of Esau, the angel that he was fighting, they shall remain assured that they will not perish, but their progeny and name will endure forever, and a redeemer will come and deliver them from the oppressor's hand. Remembering this matter always through the precept which will serve as a reminder, they will stand firm in their faith and righteousness forever. So it's interesting because he phrases it a little bit differently than Rav Hirsch. So Rav Hirsch says there is a battle, and what that battle was, the results of the battle was injuring the leg of Jacob, and he limped off, right? He said Jews will always limp. They will never be able to stand solid on their two legs, meaning their physical ability to stand up for themselves and to be strong and firm is impaired throughout history, and particularly when facing Esav, which is Rome, which is Western society, that we are physically weak in the face of it. And we should know that our strength does not come from our legs, meaning that's not, it doesn't, our balance doesn't come from physical. Our balance and our strength comes from spiritual. And we need to know that as Jews. If we think that we're going to be strong physically, that's a mistake. And that's why all Jews for all times remember this battle. It's not about this battle. It's a sign that all Jews in all times will be physically weak against their oppressor. But that our strength is not physical, and we shouldn't think about our strength being physical. We need to understand where our strength comes from. And it comes from our relationship with God. It comes from our soul. It comes from that spiritual connection. That's our area of strength. And if you think about it throughout the ages, I mean...
That's I like that.
I'll just quote the movie Airplane. So, from the 1970s.
Is that where it's a lightning plane?
You know exactly what I'm talking about, right? So, the stewardess is passing out reading material, and somebody says, oh, miss, do you have some light reading? And she says, sure, here's a pamphlet of all Jewish sport heroes throughout history. Right. 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 That's right. So the physical prowess is not something that belongs to the Jews.
To this day.
To this day, we do not have really famous sport heroes. I mean, there's here an occasional one or two, but it's not like we're replete with the physical. You know, it's not. I mean, it's not like the continent of Africa, which produces runners by the thousands that just can take over anybody, right? And we just don't have that. That's not our strength. However, Nobel Prizes, well, we're up the wazoo because our brains are our strength. And the spirituality of the planet right now hangs on the Jews.
Yep.
The whole concept of peace between nations is a Jewish and Jewish-only concept. We're the ones who came up with it. I mean, God came up with it for us, but we're the ones who taught it to the world. And there is no society that was concurrent with Jewish society 3,500 years ago that believed in peace between countries.
Isn't that one of the signs of the apocalypse, is peace in the Middle East?
Well, that's it could be. I mean, the apocalypse. So we want peace.
It's a sign of the Mashiach.
A sign of Mashiach coming, which will be preceded by upheavals. But the concept of nations working peacefully together, the concept of people respecting the inherent dignity of a human being, irrespective of their ability to give. So irrespective of the value of that human being, on a physical level, there's value on an intrinsic level. That's a Jewish concept also. And that all people should be cared for, irrespective of their... So that they have dignity inherently, but they should also be cared for irrespective of their ability to give or future ability to give. So if somebody's a vegetable, you still feed them and clean them and care for them for decades. Even if you know they'll never come out of that, they'll never give. It's a bottomless pit, and you still give, give, give. That's a Jewish concept, not from other nations. So all the concepts that we're working on now as a world, and we're not there yet, but working on implementing universal education. It's a Jewish concept, right? So all these concepts come from the Jews. So that's the strength of the mind, the strength of the spirit is the strength of the Jew and not the strength of the body. And that's what refraining from eating this nerve teaches us, is that it's the strength of the spirit and the strength of the mind that belongs to the Jew, and the Jew should not think that they're going to stand steady. This, by the way, was the parsha when I second met Yoshua Hoffman, the second Shabbos I spent in the hospital with Yoshua. This was the parsha, and so I read this in the Rav Hirsch, and it just got me to thinking, like, here's a man who is not going to be standing on his 2 feet, likely, the Derech HaTeva, and hopefully there should be a miracle, and he will. But for right now, he's not. But his strength is not in his legs. His strength is in his mind and his heart and his soul. And that's where he's really strong. So it was interesting to read that in the hospital room with him. Something else that I want to point out in the Hirsch. How much time do we have?
2 minutes.
Okay, good. Okay, so in the Hirsch on Vayishlach, it talks about the word, because Rav Hirsch likes words, talks about the word nasha, gid ha-nasha. So it must be on 509. Okay, it's really on 508. Yeah, 508. Okay, so nasha. So this fascinating concept. Nasha, the root of nashim and of nasha, creditor, seems to have the underlying meaning of having given oneself or something of one's own into the power of another. To have fallen into the power of another. So now we're talking about Gid HaNasha, right? He was injured in the Gid HaNasha. That's no longer in the power of the Jews. It's in the power of Esav, that sinew. But also women, the root of women, something that's in the power of another. Hence, Nasha, being in somebody else's power, regarding a part of one's possessions, to demand something from him. Transposed to the loss of some mental possession, Nasha does not mean so much forgetting as giving up. The root of isha, woman, in the singular, is not nasha, but ish. Ki me'ish lakcha, because, and that's quoting the verse in Genesis where she was made, from because from man she is taken. For in the singular, her relation to man is that of wife to husband. She is not something given over to the power of another. This is way before the feminist movement. She is a co-worker, a complement to man, placed completely equal to him. Isha, a feminine man. That's the translator. But in the plural, as a sex, the public relation of the feminine sex, her rights are represented together with those of her husband. Only in public life, in the plural, as a sex, do women appear as powerless, weak. But they are nashim, the creditors of the opposite sex. And I think this is a fascinating commentary. It's hard to understand, so let me try to summarize what I understand out of this. Nashim together and Isha singular are two separate concepts, he's saying. Isha singular, each individual woman, is the co-equal of a man. And may have a different role, be a complement to, but co-equal, co-worker and co-equal. However, we see that in society, women are clearly the weaker sex. What does that mean? Collectively, we actually are creditors to the men, meaning they owe us. We need them to protect us, but it's their job to protect us, and it's their job to fund us. It's their job to care for us. They owe us. We're their creditors, right? So they owe us, but we seem weaker. So it's an interesting thing because I've often thought about within the Orthodox community, especially the right-wing Orthodox community, and this is not Jewish, certainly in the Torah, women are equal and respected. But occasionally in practice, we see that's not always the case. So what I've noticed in the right-wing Orthodox community is that while each individual wife and mother and daughter is highly respected,
absolutely,
sometimes as a group, women are not. So it's interesting. It's interesting to see here inside that individually, tremendous respect. As a group, they're the women. You know, they're just the women or whatever. So it's interesting to see sometimes the dismissiveness of women as a group. That there's not equal pay. That's incorrect. I'm not saying it's based in Torah. I'm saying this is behavior not based in Torah.
So he's,
but it's interesting
so,
here to see what. Yes, yeah. Yes, they're creditors for us. That's what is what Rapersh is saying.
So when he's saying that's the way.
He's saying, but what he's pointing out here is that there is a difference between the individual woman and collective women in the way society relates to them.
But not in the way that they
should be related to.
Okay, that's what
right.
I'm trying to open.
So they have
right.
two different root words.
Yes. And that's what he's pointing out here. It's so interesting. So nasha, gidha nasha, the sciatic nerve, really, it's we are calling it sciatic in English, but it's really the nerve of credit. And nashim is the same root, creditors of the men. So.
But do you think maybe that's almost like putting up a fence because other men are not supposed to interact with, you know, with other women? You know, I mean, there's
I think that there are multiple factors as to why women as a group are, as a group and only in certain communities, but as a group and sometimes generally dismissed more easily than they should be. But so there are many reasons for that. There, none of them are Jewish reasons. They're all societal reasons that come from different societies or reasons of mistake. Like, yes, for instance, what you're saying, we do need to be very careful in maintaining respect and distance from members of the opposite gender in order to protect our own marriages and the strength of our marriages and the strength of our relationship with our individual man. So we don't want a bunch of fraternizing going on so that there's lightness or levity and so that barriers are broken. We don't want that. But we shouldn't go from there to women are bad.
Oh, no.
Or not
right?
worth talking to.
Or the opposite. I mean, a girl in our community recently got engaged, not my own daughter, but somebody else, got engaged and commented to my daughter, "I can't believe I'm engaged to a boy." Meaning, no, but the concept is like, oh boy, you don't talk to boys and I'm engaged to one. You know, so after all those years of being separate, it's not just, unfortunately, we have devolved to a place where it's not just separate, it's separate and bad, or they're bad, so be separate. Not they're so special and your marriage will be so fabulous that you need to be separate now in preparation for the amazing connection that you're going to have later, the amazing and singular connection. Because that's a lot to explain, and it requires explaining something about sex at some point, which you don't want to do to a 12-year-old, a 10-year-old, an 8-year-old. So the easiest and incorrect thing to do is say, boys are bad.
And what do they tell the boy?
Girls are bad.
Right. Well, but it's pretty hard to create a special great relationship if you have a whole 13 or 15 or 18 years of...
Right, so it does actually make for a difficult...
That's not true.
No, well, yes and no.
Instinctively, they know that...
There is instinctively, they know, but there is actually, and you need to know, in the right-wing community, there is a lot of difficulty with the initial transition. Into closeness and into sexuality and into respect on both sides. It actually takes a few years to iron out, and sometimes a long time to iron out.
I mean, just logically, knowing human nature.
Right. It does. It does. It's not abandoned in the first moment of engagement at all. It does make for a difficult path.
And arranged marriages?
We have assisted arranged marriages in the right-wing community. So the parents check out each partner. But and then the kids are introduced once the parents would be happy if the kids like each other. If the kids don't like each other, start again.
Moving on.
Okay. Yeah. So it's not
arranged.
The suggestion is arranged, but not the actual marriage. The introduction is arranged, right.
Yeah.
But the kids get 100% yes or no power.
Unless they meet on the train to Richmond.
Right, in which case the girls has all the rule. Right. Right.
So what does this have to do with the sciatic nerve?
Okay, so what it has to do is just the root of the word.
It
just has to do with the root.
That the root nashe, it has nothing to do with sciatic. Sciatic is the, let's call this an idiomatic translation. We have a lot of times we use idiomatic translations. So that they're not literal translations, because the idiomatic translation gives us a better idea of what we're actually talking about.
Okay, so nashe is...
I thought it was you just didn't want to be taken
woman.
From that part of an animal because it wasn't as clean.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Uh-uh. So it's really creditor.
Yeah, so it's really creditor.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So nashe is what?
So nashe creditor. So it's just saying that's creditor. The root. So it's, and it seems, so here he's saying, he's speculating too, because he says seems.
Yeah.
Seems to have the underlying meaning of having given oneself or something of one's own into the power of another, or to have fallen into the power of another.
So the Jacob story.
Right, so the Jacob story is that it seems to be that he has, that part of himself has fallen into the domain of Esav. And yet, it still belongs to us. Just Esav hasn't. So Esav clearly has strength. A holy Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. You know, was neither a holy nor, so discuss. So the Holy Roman Empire was based on strength. And it's interesting because our strength is shifting now through America, which considers itself in a way, in its root, to be the new Jew. And that's why Lady Liberty holds her light up to be a light unto the nations. Mm-hmm. But the early founding of America does have a consideration of being the new Jew and manifesting Jewish destiny, or biblical destiny. Yes, that's a whole different class, but it's fascinating to know that is the case. And so,
anti-Semitic, though.
Hmm?
They were really anti-Semitic.
Well, so the actual Jew was a problem, but the Bible and the Bible's code for how one should live was taken very seriously to heart, even though they were Christians. So the actual Jew would be then in their minds a God rejecter. So you'd want to be anti-Semitic against the Jew, but totally embracing of the Torah and what it's teaching.
Okay, some were deists rather than...
Those are the later... So the founders, the founding document authors were deists, but the early founders of the country were actually Christians.
Right.
And so in their Christian philosophy, it was about manifesting biblical destiny.
Sounds like a split personality.
Yeah, a little bit, but yeah.
Rejecting the Jew, but embracing
the Jews' teaching. Right, right.
Well, but that was traditional Christianity.
Yes,
at that time.
Absolutely.
So,
absolutely. That is the fundamental, basis of Christianity is to reject the Jew and the way the Jew teaches it and make it into the way the Christian teaches it.
Like the Muslims.
Yeah. Absolutely.
The Muslims,
right.
Sort of all the same.
Right, yeah. You're taking, it is in a way, yeah. It's bastardizing the teaching of the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Right.
So, Right, so So the American strength, that's what I wanted to say, the Jewish concept of strength is the strength of the idea, not the strength of the body. So the American concept of strength is slowly switching to that, where when America was founded, war was strength, but today diplomacy and ideas, and anybody who's smart is not just working on diplomacy, which actually is just to avoid war, but actually trying to put a laptop into the hand of every child and hotwire the world so that ideas will be spread. Universal education. Once you educate everybody, make everybody literate and everybody thinking, the world will come to peace. But that is an American idea. We are moving towards that direction. That's what I'm saying. We're moving from strength of arms to strength of mind as a paradigm for creating peace as Americans. And that is expressing a Jewish idea. It's slow. It's slow, but it's happening. Look at 200 years ago and look at today. It's a very different paradigm of how we're conquering the world. The pen is mightier than the sword in the end, and that's why China is trying to circumscribe the internet.
But what about peace through strength?
There is a concept of peace through strength, too, but we're hoping that the strength is really the idea, the strength of the idea. Because if it's peace through strength of arms, then you have to constantly maintain that strength. If you want to be able to have synergy, which is past the end of war, you could maintain no war with strength of arms, but you can't get to synergy with arms. You have to get to synergy with ideas.
How about your
Ahmed Dijon? Yeah. Yamach Shema B'Zichro. Take it to every page. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's more. Yeah. You have everything?
Yeah. Okay, good.